Hi, I'm Zach Warmbrot with Politico. Thanks for doing this. I wanted to see if you had any reaction to the Dodd-Frank alternative that House Financial Services Committee Chairman Jeb Hensarling has proposed, because it is his attempt to attack too big to fail. And I'm curious what you thought.
Yeah, I have not studied it in detail. I looked at it. I've just read some of the press articles covering it. I'm appreciative of any member of Congress who wants to get involved and revisit whether or not we've done enough. We're looking at that as a set of ideas as we're considering our own plan. So we welcome the fact that he's put forward a serious plan and looking at some of the elements. I think from what I recall, it has some elements of higher capital standards. I think directionally that's a good thing. But we're looking at the kind of analyses that we looked at today to figure out what is the right level. I don't know what the right level is yet, but it's, we welcome his ideas.
And he suggests a trade-off between higher capital and lower regulation elsewhere, including Basel liquidity rules. I mean, do you think that's an okay idea?
Well, I'll tell you this. I hear, especially in our district, in the Ninth Federal Reserve District, we meet with a lot of community banks that are suffering under the new regulatory regime. So whether this is specifically what Congressman Hensarling was going at or not, I'm not sure. But the notion of let's solve too big to fail and then relax regulations on those who are not systemically risky, I support that philosophy.
Yeah, Mr. Kashkari, Tim Weatherhead, Market News International. Just curious your thoughts on the Fed's most recent decision to leave interest rates unchanged, your outlook for the rest of 2016, and how many rate hikes you see for the rest of the year. Yeah.
I don't find it productive, personally, to predict the number of rate hikes. I know I obviously do it as part of the SEP, which I contribute to, but I think that that's probably the right way to communicate that. My outlook is for continued moderate economic growth, inflation gradually returning to our 2% target. And then I think you can look at the SEP. Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about sort of the two sides of the
I'm sorry, could you
identify
yourself? Thank you.
From the Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.
You have on the one hand Fed policymakers and regional presidents talking about sort of this tepid recovery and some concerns, obviously outlined in the statement from last week about a sharp slowdown in hiring. You have that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, proposals like TLAC and this GSIB surcharge potentially going into the stress test that would make capital requirements more stringent. Are those two efforts at odds? Do you think do you have any concerns that some of these efforts, like the kinds that you're talking about, could constrain lending and constrain growth at a time when the economy is
We absolutely have to be conscious of what the economic effects of any new regulatory plan or any regulatory changes. And that's why, for example, the first panel today was all about the cost, not just higher capital levels, what's the optimal level of capital, what are the costs. So those are things that we're trying to factor in. But we can't let that paralyze us. We are going to lose our window to address too big to fail because memories of the crisis are fading. And so, if you look at it a few years ago, we're coming out of 08, Dodd-Frank is being negotiated. I think the view at the time was the economy is far too fragile to do anything transformational then. So here we are 5 or 6 years later, the economy is stronger, not as strong as we would like. If we're not going to act now, we're never going to act. And so we have to have our eyes open in terms of what the consequences are, but we can't let that paralyze us, because then 20 or 30 or 50 years from now, we may really regret it.
I was wondering, given the amount of investment that regulators in Congress have placed into the Dodd-Frank Act, how much do you think any recommendations you make will have any impact?
Well, yeah, we'll see. I mean, I'm pleased that so far people seem to be paying attention to what we're doing. I thought there was a risk that people would just ignore us and say, hey, we've already addressed this, there's nothing more to do. But it seems like a lot of people on both sides of the aisle recognize that more probably needs to be done. And so I'm pleased that coming out of the gate that we have very serious thought leaders like Adam and his colleagues at the Peterson Institute and other experts around the country and around the world who are participating. I'm pleased that we've seen politicians on both sides of the aisle come out and say, this is an important initiative that we're going to pay close attention to. And so we'll see. At the end of the day, it's going to require the American people need to make the call through their elected representatives of have we found the right balance with safety, soundness, and costs. We want to give them as much information as possible to make an educated and informed decision. But then at the end of the day, it will be up to the elected leaders to make that call.
Sam Fleming from the Financial Times, obligatory Brexit question. How big a threat to that outlook for moderate growth that you've just mentioned would Brexit be? And among the responses is a reduction in the target range, one response the Fed might need to consider if there were to be disruptive results in financial markets.
I think our base case is moderate direct effects on the U.S. economy in the near term. Obviously, I think we think it'd be better for the world economy if Brexit, if Remain is what the vote is, but moderate direct effect to the U.S. economy. If we're wrong and it ends up being a much larger effect, then I think all policy options would be on the table in response to that. The bigger concern that I have is not the near-term implication of a Brexit, it's the long-term implication of a Brexit in terms of what does it mean for the Eurozone itself. You know, I go back and think about the American history, and the U.S. fought a civil war over our Constitution and preserving. It was ending slavery, and it was preserving the integrity of the Constitution. And sometimes these things take a long time to sort out.
May I follow up just to ask about the financial stability risk that you see
Sure.
from Brexit?
Again, direct financial stability risk, I think, seem to be modest based on what we know, based on the direct linkages, the financial market implications. But these things are always uncertain. You know, unfortunately, you never know with great confidence until they happen.
Mariah Costa with SNL Financial. I wanted to follow up with what Zach asked earlier about Penn Sterling's proposal. One of his proposals is getting rid of Title II and the TLAC and instead replacing it with Chapter 9 bankruptcy. What are your thoughts on that and that proposal, and do you think it's good? Thanks.
Well, I haven't studied the Chapter 9 proposal in detail. But many of my concerns that I have about TLAC and bank resolution also apply to various bankruptcy proposals, which is it really reasonable to expect either a court or regulators to impose losses on bondholders in the middle of a crisis, or does that just spread risk and increase uncertainty rather than control risk and contain risk? And so I think some of my same concerns would probably also apply to the bankruptcy option as well.
Following up on financial stability, what is your view on using monetary policy to deal with financial stability issues?
It's an extremely blunt tool, and it makes it very difficult. I would never say never, that we would never do it. But I go back and I think historically, in 2004, if the FOMC had the wisdom that there's this big housing bubble forming, would they have really been able to tell the American people, we're going to put the U.S. economy in a recession to prevent this housing bubble from expanding and then ultimately bursting? And I think that's how you have to look at it, because it's such a blunt instrument. If they raise rates enough to prevent the housing bubble from expanding, you probably would have been putting the U.S. economy into recession. And so, again, I don't want to say it's impossible, but I think it's a pretty high bar to go down that route.
Jake Schlesinger at the Wall Street Journal. So I, and I think a few people in this room before coming to hear you speak, were on a background call with the Fed about the upcoming DFAST and CCAR test coming up. And then listening to you speak, it feels like your view is, in a sense, this is an exercise that is best irrelevant for rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, and possibly counterproductive in that it's overly complex and puts too much focus on the notion that regulators can actually solve this. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that roughly accurate, or how would you describe it?
Well, I think stress testing generally is a good exercise. I think the stress tests were part of the solution in restoring market confidence in 2009. It's just incredibly difficult to foresee the future. I'll give you an example. So since 2008, all of our eyes have been wide open looking for economic shocks. And I don't know anybody who predicted oil going from 150 to 26. That's a huge economic shock. Now, good shock for consumers, bad shock for oil producers, but a huge shock to the economy nonetheless, and we completely missed it. So what I'm saying is, let's keep looking, let's keep our eyes open. Maybe we'll see shocks coming, but let's build a regulatory framework that assumes that we don't, and make sure that it works even if we don't see it.
As came up today in this discussion, there is this issue, as the IMF representative put it, of do you build a seawall, and if so, how high? In other words, your stress tests, there's issues of complexity, there's issues of will to implement them, but ultimately it's also the really political decision and the thing that we were discussing today is how much insurance should you be buying? And if you buy a higher level of insurance, that tells you something different about the stress test, and we're not there yet.
I think the seawall analogy is a great one. I think about percentage capital, whether it's 5%, 10, 20, those are feet on a wall. And you're trying to protect against how big a tidal wave do you want to protect against, and how much is society willing to pay for that wall, to pay for that protection against that tidal wave. And we're trying to size the height of that wall relative to the frequency and of the likely tidal waves that are going to come at us. In the end?
In terms of, so for the living wills, you argued that the results showed that the banks were don't seem ready for a crisis. But the argument that regulators seem to agree on is that even though most of the banks did not receive a credible rating, credible determination, that they still have gone through a lot and have restructured themselves to a pretty large degree, and that still makes them much more ready for crisis today than they were before 2008.
I think there's no question a lot of improvements have taken place, but A for effort is not good enough, right? Just because the living will is 10,000 pages or 100,000 pages, sometimes when you're in grad school, and if your thesis is enough pages, your professors say, okay, you've done enough. I don't think that's good enough here. I think we actually need to have credibility and confidence that these things can work in a crisis.
This is Yoko Moscow, she's the first Japanese news agency. I'd like to listen to your opinion about recent President Lula, President Lewis, he said that maybe one rate hike for the 2.5 years will be over thinking of a new picture in the future.
Right. Well, I appreciate President Bullard's outside of the box thinking, because a lot of us, when we think about the economy, mean reversion seems to permeate everything that we do. We just think the economy over a couple years is going to go back to some type of normal. And what President Bullard is doing is very provocatively making us question that fundamental assumption. And so I'm probably not yet where he is, but I applaud that he's pushing us to think about a range of different scenarios, and I think that's one way that he's expressing it.
What about his criticism to the S&P situation? How
Yeah, I think that these forward guidance can be very, very powerful. And it maybe doesn't always work out as you think it's going to work out when you start. And so I think he's asking very reasonable questions about, is the SCP achieving the policy objectives that we want? If it's not, would we consider changes to it? And I'm open-minded about it. That was only my fourth FOMC meeting, and I've only had two SCP submissions so far. So I don't consider myself to be the foremost expert yet on the design of the SCP.
Patrick Greco's orders. Pardon me if you addressed this when I was out of the room, but something you mentioned, two potential risks of, if you want to call it, over-regulating some of this, driving some lending into the non-insured or non-banking sector, and then you would even constrict worthy creditors from getting a loan. Can you think that through with me a little bit more? I mean, what would be the signs that's happening? Or are you seeing it anywhere even now?
Well, some signs. I mean, I got a mortgage I'll give you an example, personal example. So I applied for a mortgage when I bought my house in Minnesota, when I was moving to Minnesota, and it was an extraordinarily painful process. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I thought that the banks were playing a joke on me in how much documentation they were asking me to provide. And I was going to a bank that I've been banking with for a dozen years, so there were conversations where I said, you have my checking account data. You can see that I've been paying my rent for the last X number of years. And so I just personally felt it, that the regulations have swung too far in terms of the behavior that is forcing banks to adopt as they're evaluating borrowers. Now, I had the determination to see it through that process, and I was able to get a mortgage at a very attractive rate, but it still, I think it would have dissuaded a lot of other borrowers who maybe in other scenarios would have easily qualified for a mortgage. So there are real costs on what does it mean for Main Street. But again, at the same time, we just have to assess, are we finding the right balance?
Is there a just for the record, I realize I'm not focused here, but there is a policy consensus among people who work on this in 2 points. First, that despite what some regulators say, moving some activities into the non-bank industry is actually can be a good thing because they're not part of the insurance safety net, and if they blow up, they don't take things with them. And second, that raising the costs of borrowing can be a good thing if you think that there was excessive, say, consumer credit demand in the bucket. So yeah. just understand
yeah,
that.
And I don't have much time left, but I mean, you thought the industry, and they talk about, you know, put the capital requirements aside if you can just for a second, and just what the credit box looks like now compared to 10 years ago. And is that reasonable? And, you know, that's just not a very precise question, but still, I mean, it just didn't even a sense of what, you know, who's playing vanilla lending, and if that's...
Yeah, I mean, again, it's unfortunately, these are the types of things you can look at. We look at the loan officer survey, we look at actual lending levels, credit is being provided in the economy, mortgage rates are low on any kind of historical basis. Those would all indicate that credit is flowing, that the pendulum has not swung too far. But at the same time, when you meet with individual borrowers, you meet with especially community banks, look, we've made the economies of scale advantage that big banks have. We've made it bigger because there are fixed costs associated with having a compliance officer. And when you add one compliance officer to a small bank, it really changes their profitability. If you add one compliance officer to a big bank, it doesn't have as much effect on their profitability. So the too-big-to-fail problem, in some sense, has gotten worse as a result of some of these regulations. And so that's why, to an earlier question, if we can address the too-big-to-fail risk, I do believe that would give us an opportunity to relax regulations on some much smaller institutions that are not systemically risky for the economy.
Greg Rapp from MarketWatch. I guess you talked in your speech a little bit about how banks are the banks and the lobbyists are attacking your ideas. But I mean, really, Washington and the regulators and the people who put together Dodd-Frank are pretty cool, too. Bernanke came and sort of said, I guess, let's wait a while. So what do you say to those people who put together Dodd-Frank who just think they've done a lot of work and that you should wait?
Well, I say to them, I hope you're right. But if we wait too long, should we wait another 8 years and then lose our window? What happens if 8 years from now, when, okay, everything's finally done, we conclude we haven't done enough, and then we've missed our window when the country still really remembers how painful the crisis was? And so I feel a great sense of urgency that we need to move now to make this assessment now, not wait till everything is completely done and that there may be no opportunity to make further improvements.
The FedUp coalition is out with a report today saying that the regional Fed boards should start having academics, labor leaders, community activists on their boards, and people who pay student loans or mortgages. I mean, do you see a lack of diversity on these regional Fed boards or yours in particular, and do you think they have a point?
Well, I haven't seen the FedUp report, but look at our board. Our chair of our board is a very impressive woman who runs a nonprofit. She's dedicated her life to serving basically the St. Paul community in a nonprofit capacity. Another one of our directors is a lifelong labor leader, Harry Melander, in the Minnesota area. And then we do have a large company CEO as well. So we've worked very hard to have diverse representation from the 9th Federal Reserve District on our board. And I think that's a real strength of our Federal Reserve Bank. And so we're going to continue to do that. I mean, as people roll off, to the extent that we have an ability to recommend people to potentially be considered, we are recommending very diverse people from a wide range of backgrounds. What we strive for is we strive for geographic diversity to cover the 9th District. We strive for sector diversity, so labor, business, nonprofit sector. We strive for gender diversity, and we strive for ethnic diversity. And there are only 9 seats, so it's hard to capture every element of diversity that you want when you have a population of 9 seats. But I think the Minneapolis Fed has done a great job at that.
Yes, sir. I was just curious your reaction to the May jobs report and whether or not you expect a rebound in June.
I'm hoping for one. You know, I took a lot of optimism watching the labor force participation creep back up over the prior several months, and that has some of those gains have been reversed in the last couple jobs reports. Now, I'm hoping that it was just a blip and that we start going back and seeing the kind of numbers that we were putting up over the prior year. But it's something we're paying very, very close attention to. I don't know yet if it's a blip or not. I certainly would love to see more Americans reentering the labor force, see labor force participation start creeping back up, even holding the unemployment rate steady if that means people are reentering the labor force. That would be a good thing, and we want to see that happen, but I don't know.
How will you know if it's a blip or not? You know, what do you need to see to convince you that this is something that's more of a lasting trend?
Well, unfortunately, it's more labor. First of all, we look at a lot of different labor indicators. So the jobs report itself is only one important indicator, but it's not the only one. So we just need to continue to watch the data and see more data across all of the various measures as they come out.
Great.